I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The British government says it's willing to send 500 more troops to Afghanistan. Prime Minister Gordon Brown made the announcement in Parliament today. But first, he opened the session by reading the names of all 37 British soldiers killed in action in Afghanistan since July. Brown ended his reading of the list this way.
And from No. 34 Squadron, Royal Air Force Regiment, Acting Corporal, Marching Wojtek. Nothing can erase the pain for their families. Nothing can be greater than the pride we take in their contribution to our country and our sadness at their loss.
As for sending in more troops, the British Prime Minister said he's responding to requests from his military commanders in Afghanistan. But he added certain conditions must be met first. The extra British forces must have proper equipment and training, he said. The Afghan government must commit to training more local forces. And Brown said other NATO member states must also commit to sending reinforcements of their own. The key decision there, of course, is the one President Obama will make. He's reviewing U.S. troop levels right now. We're going to spend the next few minutes speaking with a couple of veterans of the war in Afghanistan. First, retired British Army Captain Doug Beattie, who won the Military Cross for bravery in Afghanistan in 2006. He returned for a second tour of duty in 2008. Mr. Beattie, 500 more British troops doesn't sound like a lot. How important is this?
It sounds quite meagre, doesn't it? But actually, it's very, very important because actually the headline figure that you have from British forces in Helmand, in the south of Afghanistan, is of the 9,000 that we have there now, something in the region of only 2,400 are actually frontline combat troops, so-called boots and bennets on the ground, who are grinding away at the Taliban on a day-to-day basis. So these extra 500 troops will actually be a huge boost to that force and will give us the ability to dominate ground that we have taken and had to hand back to the insurgents on so many occasions.
Right. Helmand, is that where you were?
Yes, it was, yes. Which is in the south, just adjacent to Kandahar province.
Right. And so when you were there, did you see signs of just how the British mission was suffering because there were too few troops on the ground?
Well, exactly, and that was the problem. And the very common term that we were using was called cutting the grass. We would go into an area in the Upper Sangin Valley or the Upper Goresh Valley. We would clear it out of insurgents, but we wouldn't have the force levels to be able to stay there to dominate the ground. We would have to withdraw. And the moment we withdrew, the insurgency would come back again, hence the grass would grow. With these extra troops, it means that we can take ground and now we can hold it.
Stay with us, Mr. Beattie. I want to go to Washington, D.C. right now to have Kyle Flynn join the conversation. Flynn also did two tours in Afghanistan as a U.S. Special Forces non-commissioned officer. Now, Mr. Flynn, you served in Uruzgan province. Shed some light for us on why this type of counterinsurgency campaign is so labor-intensive. I mean, here in the States, we're talking not 500, we're talking tens of thousands of potential new troops.
Well, if they're switching to the population-centered counterinsurgency strategy, then the idea is to get in, work, and live in the heavily populated areas. In Afghanistan, that's particularly difficult because of the rural terrain and the geography, and the villages are so spread out. We were working in a small town called Deraoud, which is in the southwest corner of the province, right where Helmand and Kandahar meet. In this situation, we went in trying to work by, with, and through the local forces. We were not going to do any unilateral missions if we could avoid so.
I mean, to get in and live among the population, that sounds like you're aiming to win hearts and minds. Adding forces like that, will they have to have those kind of capabilities to live in and among the population, as you're saying?
Right. I think the idea is you just have to provide some level of security before you can accomplish anything else, including any type of development, any type of governance. There has to be security before any of those other things can follow suit.
Well, let me ask you both about a long war in Afghanistan where success seems so elusive. When you were there, can you tell me about one experience, each of you, that you think was successful and what made it happen? Mr. Beattie.
Well, you know, many victories that we have there and many successes are always tinged with a slight degree of failure. But I remember when I served in 2006, we were extremely light on the ground with troops, but yet we went down to a place called Garmsir in the south of Helmand. We were able to take it and we were able to hold it using indigenous forces to be able to hold that place. The US Marines moved in there subsequently and they've had what they've termed as a catastrophic success, where they've completely swamped the area. They've taken control. The population are flooding back into the villages. To me, that's an outstanding success brought about from very small means to a major operation.
And Mr. Flynn, do you have a similar story?
Yes. We landed boots on the ground in Uruzgan in Deraoud in early October 2007. Our main objective was to go and secure, and by doing so, we built numerous checkpoints in the area. We fought, we cleared the land, and we were training host nation indigenous forces at the same time to man those checkpoints. And as we ended up clearing the area, it took us about 5 months of fighting, and the last 3 months of the tour, there was not a single shot fired.
So what happens then if the naysayers to raising the troop levels in Afghanistan come back and say, well, look at these two examples. I mean, if you do this cleverly, we can control territory. We can win this.
The problem you have, Marco, is the territory is so vast. You really are talking about huge open deserts with small pockets of population spread amongst it. Or if you go to the River Helmand, sort of nearly tropical lush green along either side of the bank, you need the forces to be in there, because if you're not in there influencing the local nationals and having effect on the enemy, well, the truth is the void would be filled by the Taliban themselves or the insurgencies. So it's either British boots or American boots in particular villages and areas. And if it's not then it's going to be the enemy. So we need the numbers to dominate.
Now, the Obama administration, of course, is in the midst of an intense debate about the best way forward in Afghanistan. There are experts, including apparently Vice President Joe Biden, who say boosting the number of troops in a big way would be a mistake. Others say up to 60,000 additional U.S. troops are needed. Kyle Flynn, what do you think about that?
It just depends on the mission, what they are actually trying to accomplish there. 60,000 troops, will that even be enough? I don't think anyone really knows at the moment. It depends on how we utilize those troops and where we place them throughout the country. I even think with 60,000, there are still large swaths of territory that we would have to cede to the Taliban.
Doug Beattie, Prime Minister Gordon Brown also said today that a safer Afghanistan means a safer Britain. President Obama has said something similar here in the U.S. Why do you think the mission in Afghanistan has been a tough one with the public in both countries?
I'm not really sure what it's like in the U.S., but certainly in Britain, I don't think the government in Great Britain has articulated well enough by saying it makes a safer Britain. I mean, it's a very sweeping statement, and I think they need to get down to the fine detail and explain exactly what they mean. For me, if I look at it, I think sometimes when I look at Afghanistan, it's maybe even a sideshow to a whole regional piece, because just next door, its neighbour, Pakistan, has got its own major problems, and that's a nuclear country. So by securing Afghanistan, it gives Pakistan a breathing space to deal with their own insurgency. And if you can imagine, actually, if the Taliban were resurgent in Pakistan and threatened the nuclear sites there, I mean, what would Iran be doing now? You know, they're already calling for nuclear weapons or that capability. They would have a justified reason to have it. And what would India do if the Taliban were going to take over nuclear weapons in Pakistan? Would they stand and watch while their neighbor falls to the Taliban?
And Kyle Flynn, why do you think the U.S. is there? I mean, is the 9/11 no haven for al-Qaeda and Taliban still kind of the best case President Obama can make?
We believe that that is the reason why we're still there, to deny al-Qaeda a sanctuary from which to train and operate. I also think that now we are getting into the sensitive area of nation building, which no one seems to want to talk about in length.
I'd like to know from both of you what your kind of assessment of the Taliban is at this point. I mean, why do you think they've been able to have so much success, gains, to get so much traction on the ground in these parts of Afghanistan? Kyle Flynn.
I believe that they use a level of fear, intimidation, and violence that not even the allies can match, and they coerce the local Pashtun population into supporting them.
And Doug Beattie, what do you think?
Well, I think Kyle has really hit the nail on the head. He's absolutely right. But I think there's something deeper than that as well, is because in truth, we call them the Taliban, but that's really just a flag of convenience. The Taliban are mixed up with a variety of different groupings, from Taliban to al-Qaeda to Islamic fundamentalists, to the farmer who believes that we're in their country eroding their way of life, or in their country about to take away their means of supporting their family, which is the poppy. And they're grouping together to form what is a really exceptional light infantry, which is hard to root out when they're fighting amongst a population and your hands are tied behind your back trying not to have civilian casualties, and yet the enemy's in amongst them. They're extremely versatile in the way they do business.
And are you both saying then that the Taliban and al-Qaeda can kind of group together better than the allies can? I kind of heard that from you, Kyle Flynn.
I think the relationship has grown closer since 9/11, and I'm not sure if al-Qaeda itself is operating in Afghanistan, which we're assuming that's what we're hearing, or if they're still operating primarily in Pakistan across the Durand line. But I believe the ties are much closer now than they were after 9/11.
Former U.S. Special Forces non-commissioned officer Kyle Flynn on the line from Washington, and former British Army Captain Doug Beattie speaking to us from Newcastle, England. Gentlemen, thank you both very much indeed.
No, thank you.
Thanks.